I have been working on a tool called Podman Desktop that brings a UI to the Podman experience of creating containers. And our goal with Podman Desktop is to basically shift left developers towards Kubernetes environments.
Welcome to the Open at Intel podcast, where we're all about open source, from software to security to innovation and beyond. I'm your host, Catherine Druckmann, an open source evangelist at Intel, bringing you leading-edge, free-ranging conversations from some of the best minds in the open source community. Let's get into it.
I spoke with Red Hat's Maureen Duffy, or Mo for short, about the importance of user experience in open source software development. We talked about everything from her work with Podman to the role of diplomacy in open source development, and even our own hopes for AI. Join us.
Hi, Mo from Red Hat. Thank you so much for joining me in our KubeCon fishbowl, is what I like to call it, because
it's very blue and fun in here.
Yeah, it's a little bit like an aquarium. It is very blue. Intel blue. So thank you so much for taking time out and pulling yourself away from all the other stuff you're doing.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
I'm really excited about this conversation because we get to talk about something that I have a lot of affinity for, I suppose you could say, and don't actually get to talk about very often, and that is UX, user experience. And I think it is critically important in open source software, as in all software. And so this is going to be really good because I'd really like to get your insights about a lot of things, among them what is, as you say, unique about UX and open source. But also just the importance of, like, if nobody uses your stuff because it's too hard to use, then what's the point?
Right, exactly. You have all the features, but if people can't actually achieve anything with them,
then do you
really have a feature?
Exactly. So if you wouldn't mind, just introduce yourself a little bit and tell us what you do, both at Red Hat, but also in the open source community.
Sure. So I am an OG Linux contributor. When I was in high school, my brother brought home Red Hat Linux. I think it was 5.1. I was a chatty teenage girl tying up the phone line, so he couldn't telnet into his university to compile his homework. So he got Red Hat Linux, so he had GCC, so I could talk on the phone to my heart's content. Not that that wasn't without conflict. But in putting Linux on the family computer, I was like, hey, this is kind of cool. I can do all this crazy customization of the desktop, and I can make my own custom icons, and I can do this stuff so easy. And the app that most captured my attention, being a designer, was the GIMP. But I don't know if anybody used the GIMP in the early days.
Did. Yep.
Yeah. Was a little difficult to use. And that kind of ignited a spark in me, like, hey, maybe I could go to college and figure out, like, study how do you make this stuff better. So I did a dual degree in computer science and electronic media arts. And then I stayed for a master's degree in human-computer interaction. And throughout my entire academic career at the university level, I was very interested in how can we make all of this amazing new open source software that's coming out more usable? Because you kind of have to be pretty technical and pretty in the weeds to make use of it. These were the days when, like, I believe GNOME 2 was new, right? If anybody remembers those days.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I was in my master's program, I was interested in doing this as a research topic. I had a friend who worked at Red Hat, and I kind of just drove out to the Westford office, and I was like, hey, can I help? Can I study you and see how you build the software? Because the idea is that to understand how to design UX for free software, you have to understand how free software developers actually do their work. And while they're all over the world, mostly remote, you find a Red Hat office, you have a bunch of Red Hatters co-located. So for me and for my academic purposes, it was a great place to kind of go and study in one place over an extended period of time, not just a conference. How do they actually do their work, and how can I sort of integrate a UX practice into that?
Wow, that's a really good story. I'm kind of inspired myself now. Wow. I have to agree with you. Yeah, I was also an early user of many of these things. So I got my start in the open source world, well, with Drupal, but also I worked for Linux Journal for many years. So
We,
you know, tried to eat our own dog food. And I used, you know, in creating the website, I used things like GIMP and stuff like that on a daily basis. I ran everything on an Ubuntu desktop back, you know, 100 years ago. And at the time, I too thought that it needed improvement, and I'm very glad that there were people like you to take initiative to make that happen.
Well, and that's the thing about, and this is something that I like to talk about, in open source, when you have technical people who code, a lot of times that early motivation to code is because they want something to make their own life easier.
Yes, absolutely.
And the thing, and I am in the same boat, like my entire career, I'm using Inkscape, I'm using GIMP, I'm using PenPot. It's a newer UX design tool. I'm using a Fedora Linux desktop. My whole team focuses on upstream community design work, and we all have standardized on these tools. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think the most important reason, like, yes, there is the dogma of the whole thing. Yes, I do believe in it. But it also makes the practice of design in the open source community more accessible to more people. Because, like, we've had people in our design community upstream who, they can't afford a license for proprietary design software.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we can just download it from here. Here's all our templates. Here's all our files. Join in the fun. And they can get started. And there's no economic barrier. Like, really, the only economic barrier is their bandwidth. That's pretty much it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, guys. I can't solve that for you. But I feel that because the developers are able to scratch their own itches, by open source designers using the open source tools, they make them better because they have their buddies who are the developers and they can exert a little bit of pressure. You know what I mean? And like our design team in Fedora has a really good relationship with the Inkscape team. Martin Owens, who is sort of the lead UX developer on Inkscape, is actually in the Boston area, not far from the Red Hat office, to be quite honest. And, you know, we talk to him a lot and, like, we let him know these are the things that are hanging us up. Could you do this? Could you do that? And they're so responsive. And that's how the software gets better, is people use it and then they contribute back either issues or bugs or fixes to the community.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So let's talk about the challenges that are unique to open source.
Sure. So as a designer practicing in open source, right? Well, and just generally. So remember I talked about developers coming to open source, scratching their itches.
Mm-hmm.
That is something you can kind of do in like a drive-by fashion, right? You can just do a PR. Hey, I got my little thing fixed. All right, I'm off to the races. I'm done. For UX design, it is not something you could really do in a drive-by fashion.
Right.
You really have to have a depth, and you have to have a bit of a tenure with the team, and you have to build a rapport with the team too, because honestly, like, I feel bad about it, but as a designer, I'm basically telling developers what to do.
Sure.
I'm coming up with a mock-up. I'm saying it should look like this, it should function like this. I'm not doing the code, you are. So you have to, it's really interesting too, because honestly, like, as a person, I absolutely hate politics. But UX is political.
Sure,
because
absolutely.
You're not the person slinging the code. So you have to
and you're
build
not the end
the
user
support.
Either.
No, you're not.
Yeah.
You're almost like, I used
you may
to describe
aiding.
It as an ambassador, but you're really kind of a political representative.
Yeah.
Right? So you're sort of politicking the developers to do the things on behalf of the users. And you have to have a strong story and a strong rationale and data to back up what you're trying to convince them to do. But I think that's good too. Like, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
No, absolutely.
Because developers shouldn't be spending time implementing something that doesn't actually solve a real problem. And if you can demonstrate it solves a real problem and it's going to help users, then that's a reasonable bar.
Yeah.
So.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, I remember, you know, in a previous life having that conversation, I constantly had to remind myself that the things I was working on, they weren't for me necessarily, right? I was working on things for other humans, lots and lots of humans that are not me. And it's really important, I think, to put yourself in that headspace, you know, of this is not about me, you know?
Exactly. And, you know, you don't need any fancy tools or fancy processes. Like, one of the things that I personally, like, I have a stronger affinity to the open source community than the UX community. Sorry, guys. The UX community likes to make all these fancy names. And, like, if somebody will release a book and they'll come up with some term for some technique, and it's like, guys, you're just playing with Post-it notes. Why did you come up with this fancy term? And, like, to understand and to keep the users and what they're trying to do, the users who are not you, what they need and what their problems are in mind when you're building software, just talk to them.
Yeah.
You don't need some fancy protocol or whatever.
Framework.
You don't need to buy anything. Just talk to them. That's all you need to do.
I think that's so important in all software development. It's just the communication. Everything is really about communication and diplomacy, like you say.
Yeah.
Everything
in
open source is diplomacy at the end of the day.
It really is.
Because you can't get your PR merged if you're not a little bit of a diplomat. You can't collaborate across organizations with many, many companies and all. You have to be a diplomat. It's just a thing. I appreciate that you mentioned that. I wanted to talk a little bit about some specific projects you work on. And
sure.
I know one of them is Podman.
Yep.
What can you tell us about the work that you do with Podman?
Sure. So I have been working on a tool called Podman Desktop that brings a UI to the Podman experience of creating containers. And our goal with Podman Desktop is to basically shift left developers towards Kubernetes environments, right? Because
sure.
sort of like, I don't know, traditional is of course very relative, but say the traditional experience of a developer would be like, you have some containers, you have a pod, you're using Docker Compose to organize things, and then it gets handed off to sort of ops, and then it kind of gets converted to Kubernetes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you have a bit of a wall that it's getting thrown over. Something happens in production, but you're not the person who wrote or maintains the kubeyaml. And there's sort of like that handoff and that wall in between that makes it a little bit more difficult. So with Podman Desktop, what we're doing is, hey, so you have this tool. It lets you run your app in a pod locally using Podman as the engine. It's cross-platform, so you don't have to worry about, like, it makes it push-button simple to set up a Podman machine and you can run stuff on it. Then once you're comfortable, like, okay, I have the app running reasonably, it has tools so you can deploy a local Kubernetes cluster right on your desktop.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do, like, we have plugins for Kind, we have plugins for Minikube. Then you can take your pre-existing pod on Podman, basically push a button and push it into your local cluster. Now you have sort of a single node cluster in a Kubernetes environment that you can then see, well, how is the app behaving in this environment? Once you're happy with that, and you may be doing a little bit of a developer inner loop, trying to debug things and make sure it's working just right, then you can push it to a remote developer cluster. So it kind of, it brings the Kubernetes system more left towards where the developer is doing the work. It makes it feel more native and more friendly to them.
Okay.
And the UI is done in a way that is very targeted towards developers. It's not trying to be everything to anyone. The main filter for how we design that UI and what functionality we put in it is, will this help a developer?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I wish more things in life were created through that lens.
It is so hard, too, by the way, to like say, listen, I'm focusing on this user. I don't want all this other noise, just this user.
Right. Because
people are like, oh, you got a good thing going. Can you throw this in and that in? And it's like, well,
clutter.
If it
feature
doesn't
creep.
Help, yes. If it doesn't help the developer, no. And it can be so hard to say no, especially in an open source project.
Sure.
And it can be so hard, like somebody does a PR and it's like this really great code, but it's like, but it's not for our user. We have to say no, and it feels really bad. Not that that hasn't really happened in Podman Desktop that I can think of, but I've seen it in other projects too. It can be hard. And again, like you said, it's diplomacy. It's really a people problem.
Yeah. Well, like all things in life.
Yes.
So I think I have my own ideas, but I'm curious to hear more about yours, about why it is so important to have that more native kind of shift left experience, as you say. Like, can you go into a little bit more detail about what problems that solves for the developer to make it a little bit more close to home? Because people get into sort of a groove of doing things a certain way, right?
Right.
And even though when you're making an improvement and a perceived ease of use solution, right? You're solving a problem that we think that a person needs. But when they're kind of in that established system and then you kind of move their cheese, there is a little bit of a, I don't know, you can find resistance
yes.
or a little bit. And I wonder like how you're solving that problem in a way that you're convincing the end user that their problem is solved, if any of that made sense.
Sure, yeah, no, it makes a total sense. So there's two things I'll say on this. The first thing is that when I look at designing interfaces, I'm a little bit of a language nerd, okay? I speak Irish, I've studied Japanese, I've studied Czech. The thing that I love about language learning is when you're trying to learn a new language, it breaks your habits. Like, it's so natural for me to walk around and speak in English and not even think about my speaking English. But here we are in Paris, right? There's tons of French speakers here. And the thing about it is, like, when you're walking around outside on the streets, you see signs in French. There's no English, right? And when you overhear people you're walking by, they're speaking French. It's sort of slowly habituating you to the fact that, wait, there's another language, and hey, people actually speak it, and I can do things with it. And in the same way, you can shift sort of the Kubernetes way of doing things to the developers in the place that they're doing it, right? So you can kind of, so like for Podman Desktop 1.8, we just released this week, we've surfaced now some new UI in the tool that will let you show for your local cluster, let you show your deployments, services, ingress and routes. And it'll also read in your kube context. You can switch between kube contexts. And in that way, because they're already doing their work locally with their pods on Podman Desktop, they'll see this new information in the same way you're walking around Paris. And I mean, I don't know for you, but like for me, my hotel, I have learned the French words for push and pull just from the doors when I'm trying to get out of the hotel in the morning. When you see it and you can counter it on your everyday workflow, you were going to do otherwise, it kind of habituates you to it and you start learning. The best way to learn something that's new that breaks a habit that you have in place is for you to learn it just in time when you need it. So that's sort of a principle we're trying to take here is when the developer is already developing their tool, can we surface this alternative method of, hey, you can use kubeyaml to make a pod rather than use a compose. And then when you have it as kubeyaml, you can push it to a cluster. It makes it more natural, and it's surfacing those tools right when the developer is ready to use them and open to learning. So that's how you kind of do a little bit of a shift. And it can be difficult. Like, one of the challenges that I have spoken about with end users out in the community, I'll give an example. I know somebody who works at a government agency, and they have a Kubernetes cluster, and they don't have a lot of usage of it. They're struggling to hire developers that have Kubernetes experience because it's a state government. Like, they don't have huge salaries to hand out. All of the salaries are regulated, and Kubernetes developers can be very expensive. So their tact is, why don't we get fresh grads in and we'll train them up? And the reason I came to talk to this individual, because they were excited about PodMan Desktop, because this is approachable for somebody. And it's the reason I bring this up is because somebody who's graduating fresh from college, they have no preconceived notions of how things should be done. It's sort of a blank palette, and we can train them up in the cloud native ways from the start to build an app. We don't have to break any habits on that.
I love that education angle. I think we talk to a lot of the same people who have these the same conversation, but I do love the idea of training up this a next generation of open source developers and making things easier from the start, making security easier, making going cloud native easier, making all of these things kind of just out of the box. The default is the easy way, and I do love that idea. I wondered also if you could, speaking about education, I wondered if you had any thoughts just kind of on a personal level about people who kind of want to go into your field of UX and particularly open source. It's fantastic that you have the background that you do combining the technical field with the sort of UX education. But I also wondered if you had advice for people who may be making a career change or maybe don't have that same background and are looking for a path into this field.
I mean, what I advise people who ask me, hey, you're a UX designer, I'm kind of interested in that. Could I do that too? How would I get started? I mean, I think it starts with, I'm actually not sure which it starts with, but I'll say having an interest in the technology and having excitement and passion for how it can change human lives.
Okay.
So think about, and this is something maybe could lead it to the next topic, but a technology is just a tool.
Mm-hmm.
What UX designers bring to the table is, what is the human problem this is solving, right? Like, people do not want to sit in front of their computer for hours just spending all this time and luxury in your application. They want to go in, get it done, get out, go home to their kids, have a nice meal. Like, they don't want to spend all this time in there. And like, so many people don't realize this when they make these tools and they have all this elaborate stuff. And I think that if somebody wants to get started in the field, developing that empathy, you can do this by going into an open source project and trying to identify for that community, how is this impacting the end users? So like, I'll throw out an easy example of something that anybody could do if they're trying to kind of dip their toes in the field. I would talk to the community and I would ask, hey, so what is your vision? What is your roadmap for this tool? Like, what is the specific problems and the users that you want for this tool? And what problems do you want to solve? Then come up with like a list of, and you do this with the team, by the way. Like, don't go off on your own and do it. You have to build those relationships, because like we said earlier, this is a diplomatic process, right? This is not like a lone wolf coming in from left field and telling the developers, here's how you fix all your stuff. It's a group effort, right? So go in and build the relationships with the developers. Come up with a list. Honestly, it could be 5 things. If a user is going to use this tool, these are the 5 things they should be able to do. Then just go out and find users. You can go in the Discord communities or the Slack communities or whatever communities have been built around that project. And, just ask users. Honestly, I prefer doing online video calls, But you could do chat sessions. You could do anything that the end user is comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Book a half hour with them and just walk them through. Okay, so here's task number one. Can you tell me how you do this in this tool, or are you able to complete it? You get a wealth of information just from asking five questions for the five most important user tasks for the tool. And then you can do that. You could talk to five users. You could talk to 10 users. And then just go through the results and let the development team know, like, hey, so you have these five tasks. I talked to five users. None of them could complete task five. And just start talking to them about, here's the feedback. Here's the specific detailed feedback we got from the users when they attempted to use this feature.
Yeah.
And collaborate and brainstorm with them. Like, you don't want to jump to solutioning super quick because, you know, developers got to develop.
Yeah,
they want to jump right to
done.
The solution.
Yep.
So it's your job as a UX practitioner to constantly be focusing on what the user's trying to do. And so, hey, guys, they're trying to do this task number five. So, and then solution A, solution B, solution C. Be involved in the discussion. Have a seat at the table and work out a solution, and then coach the team on actually bringing it in. And I think anybody can do this. I don't think you need a fancy degree. I don't think you need to read 20 books about UX to do this. It is literally talking to people, and we all know how to talk to people.
Well, that's a topic for another episode. So I think a lot of development teams maybe are smaller, right, and don't have the luxury of having a dedicated UX expert to work with, and will find themselves in the position of kind of having to make it up for themselves.
Yep.
And I've been in that position, right, when you're kind of having to do everything. And I actually do have an art background, so I tried to pull from some of that, right?
Yeah.
Ergonomics, you know, German kitchens of the 1930s. And you kind of think in terms of human interaction with the world around them, which translates to the virtual world, hopefully. But I wonder what advice do you have for those type of groups? You're not necessarily an expert, but you do have to put yourself in the position of your user to try and meet their needs. Maybe you're working on a fledgling project. Maybe you just don't have a big team.
Yeah, and I honestly think the same principles apply. And I will say, this is my own personal take. I'm sure folks will argue with me, and that's totally cool. It's interesting. So related to my education, I studied computer science, electronic media arts. And I tried to do both classes during, like, it was a 4x4 schedule, so I tried to do two computer science classes, two electronic media classes each semester. My brain could not do it. Like, I could not be in both places at once. When I ended up doing all computer science one semester and then all electronic media the other semester, I did much better. I felt like I was getting more out of the material. I felt like I was progressing a lot faster. And so the challenge there that I would pose here is, when you're the person writing the code, it's really hard to also be the person designing how the interface works. It's mm-hmm. similar to, like, you'll have, for building design, right?
Sure.
You'll have, like, a civil engineer and you'll have an architect. And those are two very, and they're separate roles for a reason. Like,
yeah.
If you're the person writing the code, sorry, like, I do a bit of coding, so I don't mean to, like, be mean or anything, but man, it's so much work to implement it that way. I'm just going to take a shortcut. Sorry, users. You know, like, the way that I think about it sometimes is like, if you write the code to do a certain thing, and yeah, it's a lot of work for you as the developer, that one thing that, say, it costs you an extra 4 hours in development time, that will exponentially decrease the amount of effort that the user will have to do,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you have a lot of power as the developer in that relationship, and you have your own needs that you bring to the table. So it can be very easy to kind of sit back and say, I don't think I want to spend an extra 4 hours on this. And then sort of the effort gets passed on to all of your users times, you know, however many users you have. So when you have a designer as a separate representative of the users involved, right, that sort of makes the power relationship there a little bit more fair, that the users have an advocate that's not is not at bat to actually do the implementation work. So you can have sort of a collaboration and a back and forth and a weighing pros and cons that's a little less self-contained. But the thing is, again, people know how to talk to others. People know how to think through this stuff. If it's a small team, like, say there's three people, you could do sort of a relationship where you say, well, hey, we have feature one we want to work on. You know, hey, person A, you're the development lead. Person B, you're going to be acting as the user advocate for this feature. And you could just trade off or pair mm-hmm. off on that stuff. A developer can totally do that, but I would just always recommend for this feature X, try to be in
right.
one bucket
right.
or the other.
Right.
Don't
right.
try to do everything in one brain.
Right. Narrow your focus a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Do you remember, by any chance, a woman named Kathy Sierra?
I do. She gave an excellent keynote at GWADEC.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Oh, well, Southwest too. Yeah, yeah.
We were. It's probably the same one. And then she kind of disappeared. That's a horrible story about being a woman in tech. But yeah, I remember something very clearly from her slides. And this is I've carried this with me since, I don't know, 2008 or whenever I saw it. And it was a slide, and it's what you think your users are doing, and it's like a person with glasses poring over a manual, you know. What they're actually doing is giving you the finger. And I feel like that kind of is the essence of user experience to me.
Yeah, pretty much.
Anyway.
All the decisions that you make as the person creating the software, that you're pushing that cognitive load onto your users instead of taking it yourself, right? Like when you're developing software, like you have all this data, and like the lazy way to create a user interface is just plop it all on the screen, right? Because it takes effort to actually sift through that and think through. Like when I talk about UX design, sometimes I talk about it being theatrical. There's like an opening, and then there's scene one, scene two, scene
it's
three.
Like storytelling, yeah.
Exactly. And you have to surface just the right bits at just the right time when the user needs it. That's a lot of work.
Oh, I love that analogy, though. That's absolutely the case. Yeah. You don't need to see this button until you need the button.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you don't do that work, you are pushing that work onto your users. And like I said, the person, like the team that's making the software is like, you know, that's a finite set of people. But when you're unleashing it, and I'm sorry, I used the word unleashing, maybe that's not fair, but when you're unleashing it on the open source community, that's a massive number of people to have a set of cognitive load pushed on them. Whereas if you had just done it yourself, you would have saved them all the effort. And also, you would have driven better adoption and affinity with your application. It would be more successful because people don't want to work. They're lazy. Just let me do the thing I want to do.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, this has been delightful, number one. I love getting to talk about this stuff because I so rarely do. And is there anything that you wanted to talk about that I didn't ask you?
Yes. So, and it's sort of related to one of the topics that's penetrated KubeCon today is AI.
Oh, yes, of course. How can I forget AI?
It's all good. So the thing that I wanted to talk about is, as a UX designer, I think the people who practice UX have a unique perspective on AI. I think AI is really, like we said about, there's all this data and you have to sift through it. And that's kind of the work of a UX designer, right?
Yeah.
I'm not afraid.
No.
But there's a lot of data out there too that like there's no possible way you can get a human UX designer designing what bits of the data should be surfaced. Like a good example would be error logs, right?
Uh-huh, okay.
Error log is going to be, it's a time-based thing. It's very environment specific. There's no UX designer inside the app like designing what should be surfaced to the developer to let them know which bit is of most importance that should be raised to their attention. Could we use AI to do things like that, right? Like I see AI as it's just a tool. It's like a library. It's like an API.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do AI to do AI. You do AI to solve a user problem.
Sure.
And I think if you think of it that way, it kind of maybe reduces a little bit of the fear. Because again, like who wants to sit through parsing error logs?
Sure, yeah, that's perfect.
Right? Let the
perfect,
AI do that.
Application.
Yeah.
I like it. I am interested in, you know, what AI can do to make people's lives easier. I try to not approach it, I think, from that kind of cynical angle that I think a lot of people do. I try, you know, sometimes it sneaks in, but
when you have UX approach, you're talking about, you're always bringing it back to what's the user problem.
Exactly.
What's
the
user need to solve? I read an article in the MIT Technology Review last night, and they were talking about how just to make it a very human problem to solve.
Sure.
We have all this data out there of all these research papers of medicines that, for example, could treat cancer.
Yes.
But we haven't done trials, and to do a trial and to do all of that is so arduous, right?
Yeah.
And there's all these combinations that of things that we could use to treat some disease. You could use AI to go through all those papers and figure out, actually this might work. And then it would suggest sort of different combinations of things to try. And so they were talking about, there was a man who was 88. He had a rare form of blood cancer. There was no protocol for treating it, and they used the AI to like go through the different possible medications that could work.
Oh, wow.
And it suggested a drug that actually worked, and apparently he's cancer-free now.
That's amazing.
And it's one of those like amazing things that like it has a clear human impact. It solves a clear problem. That's when technology is at its best.
Yeah, I agree. I think a lot of the I think a lot of what people are exposed to in the kind of AI hype cycle is the very large scale impersonal types of, you know, generative AI. Look at all the, you know, fake content we can create or whatever it is.
Right.
But I think thinking in terms of bringing it closer to home, bringing it back to a more personal experience, something that can actually do for you as an individual human, I think that's a more valuable use of this type of technology.
Exactly.
You know, I was actually at an event recently focusing on personal AI and what does that mean, and imagining all of the different solutions that one might have. If you had something local, not something global, right?
Yeah.
Something local that could just process your own information and do it in a way that respects your privacy and all of those things. You know, imagine the kind of crud that we all have to sift through doing our taxes, you know?
Yeah.
Imagine the things that this could solve for us. But anyway, we'll see what happens.
That would be incredible. I hate doing taxes. It's almost that time that I gotta sit down
and push a button, go through all of my records on my laptop and just do it for me. Wouldn't that be great?
It would be amazing.
Yeah,
saving human lives.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic, and I really appreciate it, and I hope people have learned a few things about being a human in technology.
Yep. It's very important. So
thank you so much.
It. Awesome. Thanks.
You've been listening to Open at Intel. Be sure to check out more from the Open at Intel podcast at open.intel.com/podcast and at Open at Intel on Twitter. We hope you join us again next time to geek out about open source.